This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for Friday, the 19th of July, 2013. Hello there, and a very warm welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. We're very pleased to bring you extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending 19th of July 2013, which this week have been edited by Roz and Peter Lydiard. And your readers today are Shirley Parnell.
Hello.
Noel Thorpe Tracy, who will be joining us later, and Jane Harding.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Roy Faithful. Well, before we start, this is probably going to be the hottest day of the year. And here in the studio, it is a very warm welcome indeed. So, if you hear a funny buzzing sound in the background, that's our fan going, because it's going to stop us from melting. Let's have a look at what's on. Okay, well, on Sunday the 28th of July in Winchester, there's a Hampshire Food Festival market, and it's in Middlebrook Street and Car Park. There's an open garden scheme, the National Garden Scheme, and this is every Monday to December the 9th, and the mill at Gordleton, Silver Street, Sway, Lymington. Old Mill Garden, bisected by a meandering stream with areas of different character. New Secret Garden, and there's a garden walk as well. And that's from 11 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's £3 admission. And there's also one at Birdwood Grove, Down End, Fareham, and that's on the 27th of July and Sunday, July the 21st. I don't know why it's the 21st as well, but there you go. It's a small garden influenced by the flora of Australia and New Zealand. Four climate zones, arid, medium, lush, fernery. Admission £2.50. Let's look at some theatre. Nuffield Theatre in Southampton. L'Orfeo, Saturday, July the 27th at 7:30 p.m. It's a Monteverdi opera, and it's by the Southampton Youth Opera, and it's at 7:30, as I said. And for more details, please contact the box office 023 8067 1771. There's a giant cake sale in Winchester Cathedral Close on Saturday, July the 27th. It's from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The Mayor and Mayoress of Winchester invite you also to bake and bring along a cake if you can. It's in aid of local charities. If you want to know more about this, there is a website, and it's Win Mayor's Charities. That's Win Mayor's Charities at btinternet.com. There's the New Forest Show this year, and it won't be in mud by the looks of it. And that's on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, July the 30th, 31st of July the 30th and 31st and August the 1st. And it's over 600 trade stands, countryside crafts and activities, shows and displays. There is indeed a telephone number, 01590 622 409, and a website, www.newforestshow.co.uk. On Friday, July the 26th, there's an organ recital in Romsey Abbey, 7:30 p.m. and it's by John Challenger from Salisbury Cathedral. It's £5 on the door. Tuesday, July the 30th, lunchtime concert, Winchester Cathedral, 1 p.m. Susan Welland, she's a soprano, and Eunice Pike on the piano. It's free, and there's a retiring collection. Also, there's a concert on Tuesday, August the 6th at lunchtime. That's also in the Winchester Cathedral. It's at 1 p.m. and it's Arthur Parks cello and piano. It's free with a retiring collection. And finally, there's some outdoor theatre, and that's on July the 20th, 21st and the 23rd to 27th. And it's Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn by Howard Brenton, performed by the Maskers Theatre Company. And it's open-air theatre, Hampworth Lodge, Hampworth, near Landford. That's at 7:30 p.m. There's no performance on Monday, July the 22nd. The matinee performances are on Sunday the 21st, which you won't probably hear about in time, but on Saturday the 27th at 2:30 p.m. Tickets are from £10, some group discounts, and the tickets are from www.ticketsouth.co.uk or 023 8071 1818. Lighting Up Time ends on Friday the 19th of July at 5:14 a.m. and begins at 9:11 p.m. On Wednesday the 24th of July, it ends at 5:20 a.m. and begins at 9:04 p.m. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have any problems with your memory stick, there's a laminated card inside your wallet to contact Lynn Parker on telephone number 01962 862 826. She will then send you a replacement memory stick. Please replace the card inside the wallet when you send the memory stick back. Also, if you have a problem with your Sapphire player, before returning it as faulty, please plug in the mains charger and ensure that the battery is fully charged, as several have been returned as faulty and have simply needed to be charged up. So, we've got three headline stories this week, and they are anger as NHS chiefs get huge pay rise, third solar farm proposed for district, and scouts in plea for more Barton Farm facilities. So, may we have the story behind the first headline, please? Shirley.
Anger as NHS chiefs get huge pay rises. Top managers at a Hampshire Hospital Trust have received pay rises of up to 18%, while nurses have had to put up with a pay freeze. The latest annual accounts reveal boardroom pay at Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, which runs hospitals in Winchester, Basingstoke and Andover. Senior managers have had huge pay rises worth up to £35,000 in 2012-13. The Trust's annual report said it reflected the merger of Winchester and Basingstoke Hospital Trusts, which meant BOTSIS had to take on more responsibilities for a bigger, more complex organisation. A remuneration committee set the pay after comparing sums paid to senior managers at other similar-sized bodies. The four executive directors received pay rises between 10% and 18%. But the pay bonanza has angered unions. The dramatic rise comes at a time when most public sector pay was frozen last year and capped at just 1% this year. Caroline Villiers, regional organiser for Unison, which represents hospital nurses, cleaners and caterers, described the top manager pay rises as shocking. She said Unison would have hoped directors would have shown more restraint. Staff have also worked hard to bring the new trust into a good position, and they were rewarded with a pay freeze. The merger has not been easy for staff who have had to work across sites and see posts deleted. It has been an unsettling time, and this is not going to lift the current low staff morale. She added, "We would have preferred to see the money spent on vital services for the public or additional posts." The highest earning executive director is Dr. Andrew Bishop, medical director, whose pay band is now £225,000 to £230,000. This is 8.8 times the average salary at the trust. Dr. Bishop got a £35,000 or 18% rise. His pay was £190,000 to £195,000 in 2011-12. Chief Executive Mary Edwards was handed a £25,000 pay rise to bring her total pay to $190,000 to $195,000. David French, Chief Finance Officer, also received a £25,000 pay rise. His salary band is now $155,000 to $160,000. Donna Green, Director of Nursing and Chief Operating Officer, saw her pay increase by £15,000 to £155,000 to £160,000. Increases of £5,000 were given to part-time non-executive directors, taking their pay to £15,000 to £20,000. But Elizabeth Padmore, chairman, saw her salary band increase by £15,000 from £35,000 to £40,000 to £50,000 to £65,000. However, overall executive director costs fell from £1 million in 2012 to £713,000 in 2013 as two boards merged into one, and there are now fewer directors on six-figure salaries. The highest paid employee was an unnamed medical consultant, not on the board, who took home £371,000 in 2012-13. The trust is the result of a 2012 takeover by Basingstoke Hospital Foundation Trust, with Mary Edwards, a former nurse, at the helm. The Trust's Chief Nurse and Chief Operating Officer, Donna Green, said, "Executive directors' pay is set by the non-executive directors who make up the Remuneration Committee. The Remuneration Committee set the executive directors' pay in January 2012 when HFT was created. They took into account the significantly increased responsibilities of running a large, complex organisation with a turnover of more than £320 million and employing 5,000 staff. They also used comparative data for organisations of similar size and complexity, and we believe our executive director's pay is in line with other comparable public sector organisations."
And the second headline is: third solar farm proposed for district. Public to view scheme near Bishop Sutton. Plans are set to be revealed tomorrow, that's Friday, or today in fact, for the third solar farm in the Winchester district. The public will have the chance to see what Beta Solar proposes for farmland between Alsford and Bishop Sutton. Exact details of the scheme are unclear, but in a letter to local residents, URS planning consultants say it would provide 12 megawatts of power, enough for 6,000 households. URS was asked for more detailed information, but had not replied by the time of going to press. But it is likely to be highly controversial. Local city councillor Harry Verney said, "I'm surprised it covers such a large area. I would have thought it will be very ugly, extremely prominent and unpopular." Eileen Miller, chairman of Bishop Sutton Parish Council, said villagers were unhappy about the lack of information and an obscure site map initially provided. "It's too early to say our views until we have had the consultation, but there are lots of rumblings in the village. There is a great concern as it is very good farmland," said Mrs. Miller. The land, north of White Hill Lane, is owned by Bill Coles, a former Fleet Street reporter and author, whose family also farm Western Court Farm. The Chronicle understands the land will continue to be grazed by sheep if the panels are installed. The exhibition will be at Alsford Community Centre between noon and 4 p.m. and then at Bishop Sutton Village Hall between 6 to 9 p.m. Meanwhile, residents have formed Broughton Against Kronos Solar, to fight a proposal by Kronos Solar to construct a 200-acre Eveleigh solar farm within a mile of their village. If it goes ahead, they say it will contain 225,000 panels covering over 200 acres and turn attractive and productive countryside into an industrial site. At a meeting in Broughton Village Hall on Tuesday night, a largely hostile audience of around 80 people bombarded executives from Kronos with questions. A planning application is expected by Kronos within the next few weeks.
And this one is headed Scouts in Plea for More Barton Farm Facilities. Youngsters address latest forum meeting. Scouts and Beavers put their case for more community facilities when Barton Farm is built. The youngsters were supported in their efforts by Chip, Hampshire Beaver Scouts mascot, at a meeting of the latest forum group on Tuesday. Accompanied by Chip and 10-year-old Millie Chilcott of the Compton and Shawford Scouts, Explorer Scout Alex Kinn addressed the forum. The 17-year-old Barton Peveril student said, "This is how scouting begins. All of these young ones want to become scouts. It's a challenge, but a challenge that is invaluable." Millie said, "Can you make sure that Barton Farm has new large scout huts for the hundreds of children who want to be scouts? Can you let Chip the Beaver join the forum to help scouts be a part of Barton Farm?" The 10-year-old's impassioned plea drew warm applause from the councillors and the public. The latest public consultation of the 2000 home development was centred on community facilities, a hotly debated issue at previous meetings. The scout movement in Winchester is growing at five times the national average, with figures from the recent consensus showing a 10% rise in the district, compared to 1.9% nationally. Such is the demand to join the Winchester group that there are now 200 youngsters on a waiting list. The City Council Corporate Director Steve Tilbury said the council is in discussions with developers Carla to see if land could be set aside which could be used in response to changing demands for community facilities. Nothing is definite, but some land that is untouched might be provided for things like a scout hut later, said Mr. Tilbury. He also assured members that the one community centre which Carla is obliged to provide will be very typical in size, at around 500 to 700 square metres. Councillors also expressed concern about the time frame for primary schools to be built by Carla. Councillor Chris Pine said, "Will somebody please say yes, the school will be open virtually from the beginning. If it's not, then the first year or two parents are going to take their children elsewhere, and we know there isn't provision for that in Winchester." But a representative for the County Council said that new families moving in during the first phase of the development would place a burden of only around 10 pupils per year across the district. And this is accompanied by a lovely photograph of a group of the Scouts and Beavers at the Guildhall with their mascot Chip, which turns out to be approximately a 6-foot-high grey furry beaver.
And that concludes our headline stories for this week. We're now going to continue with death notices, then Christian comment, followed by letters to the editor, your say, historical items, first person, and chronicle comment. I'll start with the death notices. Bates, Joyce Marie Bates, peacefully at the Royal Berkshire Hospital, aged 87. Carpenter, Kathleen Kit Carpenter, peacefully in hospital after a short illness, aged 92. Gibson, Pauline Gibson, in Winchester, aged 78. Gilliatt, Leslie Gilliatt, peacefully at St. Catherine's View Nursing Home, aged 96. Melly, Roger Melly, aged 85. Morris, Terence Morris, at home. Moulton, Edwina Moulton, peacefully at West Holm Nursing Home. Proudfoot, Maureen Proudfoot, peacefully at Royal Hampshire County Hospital. Upton, Frank Douglas Upton, aged 89. And finally, Wood, Willis Wood, who was an ex-Hampshire photographer, aged 69 after a short illness. And now, it's Christian Comment, read by Shirley.
And this is headed, Sport Plays a Vital Part in Our Education. And it's written by Canon Rowley Ream. So Andy Murray is champion, and the nation heaves a sigh of relief. 77 years of waiting is over since Fred Perry's Wimbledon victory. Meanwhile, in Winchester, at my local tennis club, we continue to do battle on court. The summer tournament gives everyone a chance to triumph, although the BBC is not necessarily going to cover the result. Professional and club tennis are separated by a great gulf. The average club player hits the ball at a fraction of the speed of the professional. But there is something which both have in common. Tennis is played in the mind. We all have our demons to overcome, or, as we put it in the game, our monkeys to get off our backs. The lob goes up high, and the monkey says, "You can't smash, you always miss those." The result is a wild slash at the ball and a lost point. The monkey's voice is a voice of fear. The only comfort it offers is lame excuses, usually involving the sun or the wind. To overcome these voices is a wonderful lesson in life, which is why sport is such a vital part of education. It's not only to exercise young hearts and lungs. Children need to learn how to strive and do their best for themselves and for others, whether in fact they win or lose. At a speech day this year, the honoured guest told us how she was a disappointment to her school teachers. They sensed that she was not applying herself. It took another decade for her to find something that she cared about enough to give that extra 10% and stop making excuses. She became determined to succeed, in her case, in the world of comedy and broadcasting. In the Gospels, Jesus preached, taught, and cast out demons. We tend to ignore the final part, but it might be the most important of all ways that we are freed and healed. To confess the voices that divide and destroy us, to be prepared to let fear be cast out, that might be the key to wholeness. Andy Murray's coach, Ivan Lendl, has helped him conquer the voices that made him play defensively and kept him in the category of best loser. He is now playing at a whole new level, and that's what we can do too, however low fear has set the bar for us.
We've got 10 letters to the editor this week, and we're going to start with one read by Noel Thorpe Tracy.
Hello. The first letter is from John Beveridge, and it says, "The wind power will make a contribution. Sir, the proposed wind farm at Bullington Cross has generated many letters in favour or against its construction. It is helpful to be aware of the policies in Local Plan 2013, which will be applied in considering any application for wind turbines to be built in the Winchester district, and also the published target for Winchester City Council to achieve by 2015 a 30% reduction in 2004 levels of carbon emissions. Based on a renewable energy study, the local plan acknowledges that a significant proportion of the potential for renewable energy will be from wind, but at the same time accepts that there are landscape and other environmental constraints to this form of energy generation in the district. So, It is supportive in principle to wind farms, but also takes into account factors like the degree of community benefit, the impact on protected landscape and surroundings, contribution to renewable energy targets, and harm to existing communities. So, we need to accept that wind energy will make a contribution in achieving a reduction in Winchester's carbon emissions, but acknowledging that some parts of the district are more suitable than others for wind farms. John Beveridge, Compton Road, Winchester.
And another letter about power from Rodney Skinner is headed, "Where will our power come from?" Sir, I do not know about other readers, but I'm fed up with those who do not want wind farms, solar panels, fracking, etc., but they all want electricity. Where does it come from? We will need any combination of the above if we are to avoid power cuts in the near future. How many of the don't wants remember the cuts in Ted Heath's time? I do, and I don't want them again. Last week, E.ON got out of the tidal power tests in Scotland because they saw no future in it. Yet in Strangford Loch, Northern Ireland, there is a tidal turbine at the Loch entrance which works with the tide going both ways. Put a number of those in the Severn estuary and other places where the tide is strong. I don't say that will solve our problems, but it will go away towards it. And that was from Rodney Skinner, Town Close, Ropley.
And this one is from Frank Adset, and it's headed, "Blocking could lead to blackouts." Sir, given the expansion of domestic charging points for electric vehicles, as recently covered in the Hampshire Chronicle, there will presumably be an increased demand for the electricity to power them. Since running an electric car would more than double a typical household's demand for electricity, it raises the question of where the additional power will come from. Faced with the real prospect of the irreversible effects of climate change, we are at the same time closing the more polluting fossil-fueled power stations. We already face the prospects of future blackouts. Growing opposition has been expressed in the Chronicle to development of replacement clean energy sources, be they solar, power, wind, from waste generation. Should Hampshire succeed in blocking these proposals, can we expect neighbouring counties to take up our shortfall in clean power generation? In the event of such a deplorable scenario, would the last one out of Hampshire please switch off the lights? Frank Adset, Fernside Cottages, Manor Road, Durley.
Emma Back urges us not to give up on the Olympic legacy. Sir, last year at the close of the Olympics and Paralympics, your editorial urged us not to waste this sporting chance, September the 13th, 2012, adding, "It would be a wasted opportunity if Winchester failed to make the most of this newfound optimism to make sure tomorrow's sporting stars have the best facilities available right here." Contrast that with your editorial of June the 27th, which concluded, "It would have been lovely to have top-notch facilities and fully capitalise on the Olympic legacy, but we have to live in the real world. Whilst elite athletes are important, we should be more concerned with the general public." This is a false choice. Not all of us have given up on the London 2012 legacy. A well-designed facility in the right location can meet the needs of everyone for fun, fitness, family leisure and competitive sport. Our clubs serve the full spectrum of need. What is elite about teaching children to swim or do a handstand or play a new sport such as basketball? Yes, some of them may be tomorrow's sporting stars, but in the meantime, let's make sure people of all ages can participate. The pathway from participation through talent development to sporting stars is a continuum, not a trade-off. The estimated cost of a new centre at £25 to £30 million came from the report commissioned by the Winchester City Council, £25 million for a centre with a 25-metre pool and no gymnastics facility. £30 million for a centre with a 50-metre pool and gymnastics facility. Both had a large sports hall. The difference would likely be offset by partner contributions and grants a more ambitious facility could attract. Again, we are being given a false choice. Let's not give up on the legacy of London 2012. There is money, energy and technical support available for new sports and leisure facilities now, but it won't last forever. We need to seize this opportunity and build facilities that can accommodate everyone, whatever their aspirations. Emma Back, Winchester Fit for the Future.
And this letter from Councillor Eileen Berry is headed Footprint Brings Jobs and Tourists. Sir, I have read with interest and surprise remarks about Winchester losing its footprint. Not only is the footprint increasing, but it is bringing more jobs, tourism and events such as beer festivals and the Hat Fair, which brought thousands into Winchester, as well as the Christmas market. We cannot sit on our laurels, and everything now is geared to moving Winchester into the 21st century. The street market and the farmers' market are becoming a must. Where you deploy them is crucial to their success. There are so many exciting things being started that will have an end because we have committed ourselves to bringing in more people. And that is from Councillor Eileen Berry, Priors Dean Road, Hairstock, Winchester.
And this letter is from Stephen Gates, and it's headed Business Embodies Winchester's Future. Sir, read your article on page 22 last week, Lib Dems Attack City Business Charter. As readers will know, it is important for businesses located in Winchester to grow and thrive. This brings benefits for their employees, their customers, and the local community. It will not have escaped anyone's attentions how hard businesses have had to work to focus on their customers in a difficult trading environment. It is therefore to be celebrated when we can see examples of businesses, in this case represented by Winchester Chamber of Commerce and the City Council, working together in a proactive way. Far from being a gimmick, as Councillor Martin Todd was reported to have described the WCC Business Charter, it is a valuable indication of the importance the Council places on a thriving business community in the local area. Councillor Humby is a regular attendee at chamber meetings, and one of his officers is a member of the Winchester Area Committee, ensuring that news and views are flowing from the council and businesses respectively. Winchester Chamber of Commerce is also supporting the forthcoming visit of the Startup Bus with the goal of encouraging younger people to start their own business, and works actively with the council to encourage a low carbon economy via the Sustainable Business Partnership. Chamber and Council work to create an environment in which Winchester can enjoy the benefits of a vibrant business community. It is therefore slightly regretful that such demonstrations of an ongoing commitment represented by the Business Charter are not viewed positively by all concerned. I trust that a demonstration of council and businesses working together will be received positively by all political parties in the future, as it undoubtedly represents the future for Winchester. Stephen Gates, Chairman, Winchester Chamber of Commerce.
Mike Ellis writes about when the Admiral changed course. Sir, your recent article on the memorial service for Rear Admiral Sir Morgan Giles reported how surprised naval colleagues were when he suddenly resigned to stand for Parliament in Winchester. Few know, however, how precipitate his last minutes on active service were. His last appointment was Admiral President of the Royal Naval College, Greenwich. The college often hosted ceremonial dinners in the magnificent Painted Hall, and in January 1964 the guests were a dozen MPs. I was doing an advanced signals course at the college at the time, and the Admiral invited me to be his flag lieutenant, the naval equivalent of an ADC, for the dinner, wearing gold aigulettes to add to the ceremonial air. He emphasised that this should not interrupt my studies, and all I had to do was help him with the guests. All went well, and after dinner we went down to the Undercroft bar. At about 11:50 p.m, I noticed the Admiral leaving by a side door. I dashed after him and caught him up at the front, at the outer door. He said, "Flags, I apologise for leaving without warning, but I have to be out of the college by midnight. I can't tell you why, but you'll find out tomorrow. I'm grateful for your help. Now go back to the party, and don't mention this, please." Next day, his deputy sent for me and explained that the Admiral had resigned from the Royal Navy as of that day to stand for Parliament, and thus he had to be out of office by midnight. Although it was but a few hours, I had enjoyed and learned from working for him. But my most lasting memory will be Admiral Morgan Giles going out into the night like Cinderella from the ball. Mike Ellis, Downside Road, Winchester.
And this letter from Phil Yates is headed, "How Winchester Was Almost Ruined." "Sir, full marks to Balgarham for drawing attention to the destruction of certain parts of Winchester city centre in his column, Nightmare Vision That Nearly Was, Chronicle, July the 11th. When I talk to folk who have decided to retire here and show them the areas destroyed under the supposed slum clearances of the late 1950s and early 1960s, they are shocked that planners at the time allowed this to take place. Admittedly, some sections had to go, but not everything. That is one reason why the Winchester Preservation Trust, now the City of Winchester Trust, was formed in 1957 to try to stop the planners from going further in their demolition scheme. The Brooks was all but flattened, even the Heritage Centre was under threat, and that dates from 1820. The Trust tried to save the Queen's Head pub further along Upper Brook Street, where the White Elephant of Winchester, the Brooks Shopping Centre, is today, but to no avail. Hard to believe, but the planners' next projected victim was Cannon Street. In fact, they started to demolish the Southgate Street end. Council houses are there now, but the Trust stopped them in their tracks. The Broadway end of Colebrook Street went, as well as Union Street. It will be interesting to read what was proposed for Chesil Street, part of which has already gone. I wonder if number 42 Chesil Street, recorded as the oldest house in Winchester, would have been destroyed. When I conduct tours for the Trust, I point out sites of buildings that once stood there, but alas, are gone forever. Thank goodness Abercrombie's plans never bore fruit. And that was from Phil Yates of Tower Street, Winchester, and is accompanied by a photograph of the beautiful half-timbered old Chesil Rectory, which amazingly was almost bulldozed 60 years ago to make way for a new road.
This letter is from Paul Cooper, and it's headed, "Has the Council Learned Nothing? Sir, re-councillor Edgar's recent letter, has HCC learned nothing from the past 6 months of campaigning? Of course, children's needs are of priority. No one has ever argued against this motherhood and apple pie statement. What we as residents impacted by the Westgate All Through School have consistently argued and proved using HCC's own numbers are that the demand is not local. Witness Western schools' local applications only numbering 53 for this September, and that the traffic generation is grossly underestimated. Councillor Edgar's unreconstructed points come from the briefing documents of a year ago and fail to recognise the shortcomings of original proposals and the traffic remodelling forced upon HCC. Local schools expansion for genuine walk to school opportunities was our mantra. Instead of promises of unfunded school buses and thoroughly dangerous walking, scootering and cycling routes. This was reinforced by Councillor Perry's piece in the Chronicle, defending HCC's forecasting and perpetuating the myth of good walking routes and extra drop-off facilities. This is yesterday's battle. The decision is made, and we all want the best for the school and its pupils. I just hope HCC might learn to consult rather more enthusiastically and perhaps make genuinely objective decisions rather than deciding its own planning applications under the new regime Councillor Perry is promising. Paul Cooper, Cheriton Road, Winchester.
From Brian Espiner. Sir, I'm not a native and have lived here for only 38 years. In all that time, I have never seen Winchester on a BBC South Today weather map until today. I've learned to work out where we are between Andover and Horsham. Also, I have never seen any images of the city at the start and end of local news and wondered why we were constantly ignored. But now that we have finally and very unexpectedly appeared on the weather map, perhaps the BBC could find an image of the cathedral to put on the beginning or ending of the local news. Here's hoping. Brian Espiner, Chaundler Road, Abbots Barton, Winchester.
And that concludes all of the letters to the editor. Thanks to all those who contributed. And now it's time for your say. We went out and asked on the streets, passers-by, is it right for members of Parliament to receive a pay increase of 11%? And it's back to Noel for the answers.
Yes, I've got four answers here. Jeff Reed, 63, photographer of Willis Way, Kingsworthy, said, I have no problem if they deserve it, and to be truthful, I don't know how much they do. I got made redundant last year, and maybe the money could be spent keeping people in employment. And Sarah Gale, 52, a nurse of Badger Farm, said, I don't think I'd disagree with a pay rise for MPs, as they do work very hard. I think with the number of hours they work, they do a lot more than people give them credit for. And Jack Cawthra, 65, retired of Stockbridge, said, public sector workers are being asked to have no pay rise or a 1% increase, and it's not much better in the private sector. An 11% rise for MPs just seems crass and provocative. And finally, Mike Chater, 42, architect of Colden Common, said, we should be spending more on nurses' pay because of reports coming out about the state of the NHS. If they're paid a decent wage, we might see some improvement. That's a better way of spending money.
Now we're going back through all of our dusty old files and back through the years for our historical items. And we'll begin with 25 years ago, read by Jane.
And 25 years ago, July the 15th, 1988, is fire stations set to be closed. Fire stations at Wickham, West End and Titchfield look set to close within the next few years. Despite last-minute pleas from local councillors, Hampshire's Public Protection Committee recommended that the three retained stations should be closed. The committee agreed all the main recommendations contained in a countrywide review of fire cover, following a 2.5-hour debate on Wednesday, but they will now go before a meeting of the full council. The review, which took 2.5 years to complete, is the biggest ever carried out on fire cover in the county. Winchester will miss a £1.2 million windfall because of an unexpected government change of rules. The Environment Secretary, Nicholas Ridley, announced new rate support grant rules in the Commons last week. Formerly, councils got an extra £40,000 for every £100 they saved or raised. Winchester City Council expected £1.2 million over 20 months because of receipts over that period from sale of the Brooks site in August. The rules came into force 9 days ago, and income declared to the government before then remains eligible for extra grant. Mrs. Georgina Busher, chairman of the City Council's Policy and Resources Committee, said on Monday that it was very bad luck that the rules had been changed less than a month before the Brooks money is banked.
This one is of 50 years ago, dated July 20th, 1963. Selborne's plea for drainage, it's headed. Many residents in Gilbert White's village of Selborne want main drainage and want it quickly, even if it means detracting from an area of natural beauty where the world-famous naturalist once walked, a public inquiry was told on Wednesday. Although many would prefer the controversial sewage works built in a less obtrusive place than on 2.4 acres of land known locally as Little Coombe at Priory Lane, the villagers are prepared to accept them there so long as the scheme is not delayed. It is felt that this will be the case if an alternative site in another field, some 200 yards south, is chosen. A gloomy weather forecast, with equally bad prospects for Hampshire ratepayers, was given by the county surveyor, Mr. H. N. Jenner, to Hampshire County Council Roads and Bridges Committee at Winchester on Monday. He held up a prospect of more severe winters to follow this year's blizzards, and, in a plea for a two-way radio system on his department's vehicles, he said, "The absence of reconnaissance and radio may be said to have reduced us to the early jungle explorers' devices of sending messages in a cleft stick by native runner."
And two items for 100 years ago, July the 19th, 1913. The first one has a big headline, "Millionaire Hides as Engine Driver." Mr. John O'Brien, a young millionaire of New York, who has been missing for 3 years, has just been discovered working as an assistant engine driver on the Missouri Pacific Railway. Mr. O'Brien, a former association football star of Columbia University, mysteriously vanished at the close of his college year, 1910. His friends made an unavailing search for him, and he was finally given up as lost or dead. On Saturday, a friend recognised him at Van Buren, Arkansas, working on his engine, and he explained why he had disappeared. He said he became tired of being a rich man, with nothing to do but play the society game and study new ways to kill time. And the second piece is the homecoming of Sir Joseph Doughty Tichborne and his bride to their ancestral home at Tichborne Park has been marked by festivity this week, commencing on Monday, when Sir Joseph and Lady Tichborne were met at the Alsford Lodge by the estate hands, their car being drawn by ropes down to the house. Flags spanned the drive at intervals, and at the gate outside the house a triumphal arch was erected. On Thursday, Sir Joseph and Lady Tichborne entertained the tenantry and their wives at luncheon.
And 200 years ago, July the 19th, 1813, is headed "Dublin Mayor Assailed by Mob." Letter from Dublin, July the 8th. "Our city was most splendidly illuminated in honour of the glorious victory obtained by our illustrious countryman Lord Wellington. But I regret to say that that worthy and excellent magistrate, our Lord Mayor, and Sheriff Stoddart, walking as private gentlemen, were most outrageously insulted by a mob who called them orange villains, upbraiding the Lord Mayor with having presented a petition against Catholic claims, and finally assailed him and the sheriff with showers of stones and dirt."
Right, we're back to the present again, and back to Noel for first person.
Yes, this is first person by George Hayter, and he's talking about the career path to PM is narrow enough already. "People in Winchester can have little doubt about which parliamentary constituency they are in, but the same cannot be said of residents in Chandler's Ford. People there have been placed in three neighbouring constituencies in turn in the space of just 15 years or so. First, they helped elect the MP for Eastleigh, which has its centre to the east. Then Chandler's Ford folk found themselves shunted west into the Romsey constituency, and most recently they have found themselves part of the Winchester constituency, which lies to the north. By contrast, the townsfolk of Winchester have been in the constituency of that name election after election for donkey's years. Being located at the corner of three constituencies has led to Chandler's Ford being passed around more than most electoral districts, but constituency adjustment is something that happens nationwide, as the Boundary Commission redraws electoral borders to take account of movements in population. "We need to cut the cost of politics," David Cameron has been saying. A recent cost-cutting scheme, backed by Mr. Cameron, called for a total redesign of the UK constituency map, with the number of common seats reduced from 650 to 600. The Lords and Lib Dems appear to have sunk that scheme, and I hope it's not resurrected, because shrinking Parliament is a bad idea. We need every MP we've got for the sake of good government. Look at the US system for a moment. Americans choose their leader in a contest open to all adult US citizens. That means a varied talent pool of 200 million people. Retired generals, a peanut farmer, and a former Hollywood actor have all been elected president. By contrast, the UK system for electing our nation's leader is not open to every citizen. Candidates have to have a seat in Parliament. Currently, that means our Prime Minister is chosen from a tiny talent pool of 650. In practice, it's even fewer than that, because the PM has to be part of a majority party or coalition, and he has to be an MP with enough ability and drive to have gained front bench experience. So our national leader is chosen from a mere handful of people. Surely the last thing we want to do is to reduce the number of able leadership candidates still further. But that is what shrinking Parliament would do. Having fewer MPs would have other consequences. There would be less talent to man the committees that comb through draft legislation and keep an eye on everything from prisons to pensions. MPs are out of fashion, even more than journalists, but it would be crazy to undermine the nation's governance for a fashion. Binning seats would be a false economy, reducing state efficiency in all parts of Britain, as well as bringing further disorientation to voters in Chandler's Ford.
Here's Jane with the editorial comment.
And the editorial comment this week is "The Art of Spending Other People's Money." Two stories in this week's edition show that despite grim economic times, there is still money to be spent, as long as it belongs to the taxpayer. The Chronicle has revealed that top bosses at Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, which runs hospitals in Winchester, Basingstoke and Andover, have been awarded huge pay rises worth up to £35,000 in 2012-13. The Trust says it reflects the merger of Winchester and Basingstoke Hospital Trusts, which meant bosses had to take on more responsibilities for a bigger, more complex organisation. It is right that senior managers are properly rewarded for their performance and expertise, but try telling that to hard-working nurses who have had to put up with a pay freeze. They too have worked hard to adapt to the merger and have played their part, as have other health staff, in helping to make it a success. They have every right to a share. Elsewhere, we reveal that the County Council has lavished £500,000 on restoring HMS Minerva, a rare World War I warship. Deserving it might be, but is it really the responsibility of a local authority to spend taxpayers' money on this when it is cutting services and jobs?
And now we're on to items of general news, starting with one read by Shirley.
This is headed, "Hat Fair Bosses to Review New Additions for Next Year." Hat Fair bosses are reviewing plans for indoor events next year after mixed success last week. While thousands of visitors enjoyed free outdoor acts during the annual street festival, Hidden Hat Fair, a new addition to the street spectacular, was less popular, according to Theatre Royal boss Mark Cortis. He said some of the shows sold very well, and others did not sell at all well. "We did very well with some of the targeted shows, particularly the children's events here at the theatre, and we certainly covered our costs. It was the first time Hat Fair rolled out a substantial indoor programme, which was held across the city at locations, including the Drury Street Theatre and Bar 3-1 in the square. Mr. Cortes said the indoor programme would return next year, but likely in a new form. But he declined to disclose which shows sold poorly and details of ticket sales for the events. He said, "I think we will continue to do it, but probably a bit differently next year. I do not think it would be fair to the performers to reveal those details. We have tried something out for the first time, and I feel we need to give it another go before we decide whether it's working or not." Mr. Cortes added that there were no firm plans for any other changes, but they would be developed over the next few months. He added, "You have got to give me a bit of time. We've just taken over Hat Fair earlier this year, and we did as much as we could possibly could this year. I'm sure we're going to be doing a lot more next year, but we need time to think about it and come up with plans that will be exciting. We are happy with how Hat Fair went, and we had a lot of very, very pleased visitors across the city who enjoyed lots of great shows. Around 69,000 people visited the Hat Fair over the course of the three-day event, matching the previous highest attendance for the street festival in 2010.
A charity that supports older and disabled people at home. People are living longer, and that's great news, says Jean Roberts-Jones, chief executive of Eastleigh-based charity One Community. But this has given rise to a growing need for care and support for older and frail people. Jean goes on to explain that many people need very little help to maintain independence and quality of life in the comfort and security of their own home, with peace of mind for them and the people who care for them. One Community provides just that help through good quality, affordable services, in line with the charity's vision to achieve a better quality of life for all we serve. Many people are familiar with Dial a Ride and Shop Mobility, but may not know about other services that are also directly accessible from One Community without means testing or statutory referral from adult services or your GP. These include Help in the Home, Lifeline, Day Centres and the Care and Respite Service, all aimed at providing that little bit of help that makes all the difference both to clients and carers. Private day centre places, for example, where people with dementia can spend an enjoyable day out with caring and experienced staff, can be a lifeline to carers, while the Care and Respite Service provides care in the individual's home to give carers a break from their caring duties. Help in the Home provides a low-cost cleaning, shopping and ironing service in the home, including those tricky jobs like making the bed. Lifeline provides the means of summoning help at the press of a button in the case of a fall, the client feeling unwell or some other emergency, which does so much to increase the confidence of those who may be feeling vulnerable, as well as their relatives who may live at some distance away. Jean says that these are all simple, practical solutions, affordable and easily accessible, from One Community's friendly team of staff. For more information, call 02380 902 400. That's 02380 902 400.
And this article is entitled "Campaigners' Hopes Raised to Protect Land. Bushfield Camp Village Green Bid to be Heard After All." A Winchester woman has cleared the first legal hurdle in her fight to have a former military camp declared a town or village green and protected from development. Barbara Guthrie, who lives near Bushfield Camp, has fended off a move by the landowners, the church commissioners, to prevent Hampshire County Council from considering her application to register it as a green. If registered, it will thwart the church commissioner's own plans for it. The commissioners wish to develop part of the land, but allow public access to the rest. Their lawyers argued that Mrs. Guthrie failed to successfully bring her application within a strict time limit after it erected a fence in 2003 and brought to an end a key period of public use of the site. Though her initial application was made in time, it contained major defects that were not resolved until well after the time limit had expired. However, last Wednesday, one of the country's top judges ruled at London's High Court that this argument was not enough to defeat Mrs. Guthrie's application. Mrs. Guthrie said she was delighted at the result, which means the Village Green application will be heard at a 2-week planning application in the future. She said, "It was a great result and quite unexpected in some ways, because it did feel as though the day was going against us. I've heard nothing yet from either the County Council or the Church Commissioners about the inquiry, but it's really nice to think it's going to be fairly heard. I don't think the Church Commissioners would have taken this to the High Court and been so strong on the legal aspect if they weren't worried, so we feel quite optimistic over the Village Green status." The judge said the claimants were aware of the application, and not only did they not press for an earlier resolution or let the defendant know that they considered its failure to deal with the matter earlier was unreasonable, but in March 2009 they were prepared to assist the interested party by agreeing to the provision of a map for her. The judge ordered the Church Commissioners to pay most of Mrs. Guthrie's legal costs, to be assessed later if not agreed between the parties. The site covers 68 acres and is used currently, with the Commissioner's permission, by local people for activities such as cycling, kite flying, walking and picnicking, and tobogganing in the winter.
And this one is headed "Bid to Rehabilitate More Prisoners." Winchester Prison is set to become a resettlement prison to try to do more to rehabilitate prisoners before their release. The change, which will involve 70 jails nationwide, was unveiled by the Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling. More emphasis will be placed on deterring inmates from crime, even those serving short sentences in local prisons, such as Winchester. The government wants every offender released from custody to receive statutory supervision. Mr. Grayling said, "Rehabilitation in the community must begin behind the prison walls and follow offenders out through the gates if we are to stand a chance of freeing them from a life of crime. This approach is a significant step forward in our reforms to tackle reoffending, and lays the groundwork for building a genuine nationwide network of through-the-gate supervision and support for all offenders." The new governor of Winchester, David Rogers, speaking in March after his appointment following a damning inspection report, said he wanted to see more rehabilitation work. "If we're going to reduce offending, we have to start working differently to create more of a business environment, focusing on the key issues, the offenders," he said. The Offender Rehabilitation Bill, currently before Parliament, will extend statutory supervision to 50,000 short-sentenced offenders each year who will serve their time in custody in a resettlement prison and come out to a tailored package of supervision and support. Inmates serving longer sentences will be moved to a resettlement prison at least 3 months before the end of their sentence. Mr. Rogers and the Prison Officers Association branch at Winchester were unavailable for comment at the time of going to press. Paul McDowell, Chief Executive of crime reduction charity NACRO, said, "We are still sending too many people to prison when they could be better dealt with in the community, especially many of those serving short prison sentences. but putting communities at the heart of the criminal justice system through the development of resettlement prisons is a step in the right direction.
This is quite a harrowing story, which you might want to skip if you're a bit squeamish. The headline is "Father Tells of Family's Anguish After Son Impaled. Teenager Lucky to Be Alive After Slip on Fence." The father of a boy who impaled himself on a metal spike has spoken of the family's anguish, saying he wouldn't wish it for anyone. Daniel Howie, 13, is lucky to be alive after he was trapped for 30 minutes on a cast iron railing outside Winchester's Peter Simmons College. Neighbours comforted the stricken youngster while waiting for emergency services, as the Chronicle reported last week. He was released by firefighters who cut away three railings before he was rushed to Southampton General Hospital with the spike still in him. Speaking from the family home in Hatherley Road last Friday, Dad Stewart, a banker, said, "It was frightening, but I wasn't here when it happened. It was my wife here. I just arrived as they were going to hospital. It wasn't very nice. You wouldn't wish it for anyone." A relieved Mr. Howie said Daniel was now recovering at home and is expected to make a full recovery. "He hasn't done any lasting damage, so he's quite lucky, really," Mr. Howie said. People living in the area say the potential dangers of the fence have been raised before with the college on a number of occasions. But a 42-year-old Mr. Howie says he doesn't blame anyone for the accident. "Kids are kids. I probably would have done the same thing myself. I can't blame someone else for this," he said. Last week, Councillor Raymond Pearce told the Chronicle, "I was aware that boys were climbing over that fence. We were hoping to get it resolved as soon as possible before this sort of accident happened. My colleague, Councillor Martin Todd, has spoken to the college previously, and I know that residents have been saying things about it too." A spokesman for Peter Simmons College said the youngster could have used an open gate 100 yards away, rather than climb the fence, to return home after playing in the campus grounds after it had closed for the day last Monday evening. In a statement, the spokesman added, the college would review the safety of the fence, but said it was worth noting that the fence had been there for many years, at least since the Second World War.
And this article is headed, Charities Transport Office Gets Moving with Refit. Winchester's leading voluntary group has reopened its transport office after a refit. Mayor of Winchester, Ernie Jeffs, cut the ribbon at Winchester Area Community Actions Office at the Brooks Shopping Centre car park last Friday. WACA provides a number of services, including shopnability scooters and dial-a-ride, door-to-door travel for people who cannot use public transport. Councillor Jeffs said, as people get older and less mobile, or if they have other mobility difficulties, it's harder for them to get out to the shops and visit friends. That can lead to social isolation, ill health, and increased cost to the NHS and social services. WACA's Shop Mobility is a real lifeline. It is funded by Winchester City Council and has run since the late 1990s. Last year, around 1,000 shopping trips were supported through the service, using scooters, power chairs or wheelchairs, providing a boost to Winchester's economy. He added, I also hope that this event will get lots of publicity and that all of you will tell your neighbours and friends so that these superb services will get many more new users. Dial-a-Ride has made more than 12,500 passenger trips over the past year, including 1,200 for people in wheelchairs. Councillor Jeffs also thanked the WACA transport staff for their hard work providing these services in the difficult economic climate. Around 50 people attended the event, including service users, volunteers, WACA staff and trustees. And the article is accompanied by a photograph of several people on the mobility scooters, including the Mayor of Winchester, Councillor Ernie Jeffs, trying out a shop mobility scooter with the Mayoress, Barbara Jeffs, and a fluffy brown poodle in his basket.
And here we have an article about another animal. And it's headed, Meon Come Back for the Water Bowl. Ratty looks set to make a major comeback to a Hampshire river. Once a common sight, water voles have seen a rapid decline and are thought to be extinct in the Meon Valley. But now a new scheme, said to be the largest of its kind ever attempted in the country, is attempting to reintroduce the animal to the River Meon. The joint project is led by the South Downs National Park Authority, the Environmental Agency, Natural England, and the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust. The first release of the water voles is at the Titchfield Haven National Nature Reserve, where around 500 water voles were released recently through a gradual process, first allowing them to acclimatise to their new home by spending 4 days in release pens, which were then opened so they could explore. As many as 750 of the animals will be released this year, and further releases are planned at this site and other sites on the river in the next few years. The water vole population has been under threat because of a loss of habitat, pollution, and being preyed upon by the non-native American mink. And here we have a delightful little colour picture of this whiskery-faced water vole.
City Salvationists turn out for Charity Trekker. A marathon charity trek across the country continued in Winchester last week. The city's Salvation Army branch in Parchment Street welcomed Andy Peddle, who is walking 8,000 miles around Britain and Ireland, visiting every Salvation Army centre along the way. Mr. Peddle, 70, began the tour in May to raise funds and awareness for the Army's homeless and anti-human trafficking programmes, and has been to more than 480 centres so far. The Winchester members who greeted him included Chief Officer Teresa Harris, a day before she left to join the Shirley branch after 8 years in the city. She said, "It's been amazing. I know I'm only going down the road, but I will fondly remember my time here, and it's the longest I've ever been at one branch." And there's a lovely photograph of a whole crowd of people meeting Mr. Peddle underneath the caption that's on the side of their building, "Heart to God, Hand to Man." And then it says, "Andy is walking 7,900 miles in support of the homeless and victims of human trafficking."
And this article is headed, "City Jeweller Lands Prime High Street Location." Jeremy France hits out over neglected Upper High Street. A Winchester jeweller is moving down the High Street to attract more customers. Jeremy France Jewellers, one of the city's best-known independents, is relocating into the former Black's Outdoor clothes shop under the covered Pentis after 3 years of looking for a central location. Owner Mr. France said his current base in Walcott Place at the upper end of the street goes unnoticed by shoppers because of a lack of signage. He added the city council does not do enough to support businesses there. Mr. France said, "You are on your own up there and you don't get any help from the council. You only have to look at Moss Bros moving before me to see that. It's difficult to get a place on the High Street. Landlords don't look at independents when they want to move to the High Street. They want big brand names. My battle was to get a landlord to look at my books and my business, and once they did, they agreed to let it to me." But Professor Chris Turner, Executive Director of Winchester Business Improvement District, BID, said the upper part of the High Street was going through an organic change. He said, "I don't think it's a concern that retailers are leaving there, because the very top of the High Street is becoming more focused on service industries, like estate agents and solicitors, while retail is shifting down to the main part of the street where the greatest footfall is. When Pavilion left, people were concerned, but the space was quickly taken on by Barista's Coffee. It's part of an organic change." He added there was a problem with independents securing high-seat premises, but said Silver Hill would help. Professor Turner added, "The big pension funds that own much of the property there want long-term continuity, so it's difficult for independents to move in, but we are looking for Silver Hill to help. It will mean the pension funds will have to be more relaxed about proposals that come in and allow the street to become more independent." Mr. France's new shop will undergo a £400,000 refit and is set to open on November 1st. A 15-year lease has been agreed at a rent of around £135,000 per year, plus rates of about £80,000. Mr. France added, "We are thrilled to say we are opening here, and we hope our customers who did not enjoy the trek up the high street can now enjoy coming to see us in the centre. It means there will be two independent shops in the high street, along with the jeweller's Bellis, which is also owned by Mr. France." He said, "The new shop will have three floors and be three times the size. We will have retail on the bottom floor, a design suite and workshops on the middle, and a champagne bar at the top. The shop will also be hiring more staff, with two employees already added and two more sought, to bring the total number of up to 30 for both jewellers."
And this one is headed, "Queuing up for police site. Developers are eyeing soon-to-be-available premium Winchester real estate. Around 30 companies have shown interest in replacing Hampshire Police's headquarters in Romsey Road with housing. The force wants to sell its current headquarters and move into Mottisfont Court, a smaller building in Tower Street, bought for £1.5 million. It is being marketed by Fareham-based estate agents Lambert Smith Hampton, which has asked developers to formally declare any interest by September 6th. Outline planning consent for 294 flats, access and parking was granted in 2007 and then extended in 2010. But Graham Holland, LSH head of office, said police were happy to listen to other schemes, such as mixed housing. He said, "If somebody comes along and says we will pay you X or Y for the development, if we can get planning permission for a different scheme, then they would listen. What's most important is delivery. There is plenty of time, as it will take a while for police to move out. It's a big, important site, and everybody, not just police, but also the local community, wants it to be the right development." Mr. Holland said no shortlist would be drawn up until after September 6th, and that several factors would be considered. He said, "We want the people who are most likely to complete this. What we will be looking for is the right idea for the development. We want to know their track record, and we want confirmation that they have the money to buy it." A City Council planning list sparked confusion earlier this month when an application was listed from Bewley Homes to alter the outline permission and provide 128 homes. It was later confirmed as a mistake, and the application was removed from the list. Stephen Trenwith, land director at Bewley, said, "We have not put any application in. All we have done so far is request a conversation about the development. I imagine it must have been a mistake." Police are expected to leave the building by the end of 2014. The development is part of a wider police plan to save £4 million of taxpayers' money per year by sharing central services like finance and procurement with Hampshire County Council and Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service.
Let's cheer on our boys. Rallying cry for City March. The Tigers will be unleashed in Winchester next week, and a host of Hampshire dignitaries are appealing to residents to come out and witness the spectacle. The Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment, nicknamed the Tigers, is Hampshire's own regiment, and their soldiers will march down the High Street on Monday, July the 22nd. They will be exercising the right of freedom of entry, an ancient privilege which means some regiments get to parade through the city with bayonets fixed, drums beating and colours flying. Winchester Mayor Ernie Jeffs said, "The army are proud to display themselves in front of the public, and the public appreciates what the services do for the United Kingdom. We are still a garrison town, and we've just signed off on a covenant with the army, and that gives greater focus to the relationship between residents and the forces. Winchester and Chandler's Ford MP Steve Bryan said the march comes at a particularly poignant time. The public reaction to the recent memorial for drummer Lee Rigby only goes to show how valued our military personnel are, he said. At Searle's House, home to the Royal Hampshire Regiment Museum, veterans are eagerly anticipating the parade. Norman Alexander, 92, and a recipient of the Military Medal, said, "The first time I marched down Winchester in 1939 was to show that we were good boys and we were doing our bit. It's a great occasion for the county and for Winchester." The city's scouts have got behind the troops, organised by Stephen Parker, the district commissioner, and former Tiger soldier, waving banners in a show of support. But there has been controversy over non-attendance by primary schools, with some saying they weren't told about the event, a claim disputed by council chiefs. Councillor Simon Cook, a former Royal Marine, said, "I'm completely floored by this. It's a rare and lovely opportunity for our young people to see well-trained young men marching past proudly, and I think it's a terrible shame they won't get the chance." Starting from the Peninsula Barracks at 12 noon, around 160 soldiers from the 1st and 3rd Battalions, accompanied by the band of the Corps of Royal Engineers, will march down the High Street to the Broadway, before stopping in front of the Guildhall for inspection and speeches at 12:10 p.m. Lord Lieutenant of Hampshire and High Steward of Winchester, Dame Mary Fagan, said, "I am delighted that Hampshire's own regiment, the Princess of Wales Royal Regiment, will be exercising their freedom rights. This is a very special occasion, and I hope that as many people as possible will come and show their support for the regiment."
And this article is headed, "School's Clean Sweep Reflects Dedication and Commitment." A Chandler's Ford school is celebrating a clean sweep after its latest Ofsted report. Lakeside School, which educates boys with behavioural or emotional difficulties, was inspected in March, and the verdict was simple. It was deemed outstanding in all four categories, as well as for overall effectiveness. Samantha Hawksworth, chairman of the Lakeside Executive Committee, said, "We are delighted to receive the outcome of the Ofsted inspection, which is a true reflection of the hard work, dedication and commitment of all the adults in our school doing their absolute best for our pupils." A small school with just 78 students on the roll, pupils are drawn from all across Hampshire. It is categorised as a community special school, and its pupils can board there, a house within the grounds taking 18 boys. Head teacher Gareth Evans came in for particular praise from inspectors, who said, "He is determined and relentless in his focus on improvement. This is driven by his passionate belief that all students, irrespective of their circumstances, are entitled to the best possible education." Mr. Evans, who has been at the helm for 12 years, said, "I'm very proud that we have collectively achieved an Ofsted inspection outcome of outstanding in 2007 and now in 2013. The latest and toughest Ofsted framework is quite rightly focused on the quality of teaching, learning and the progress pupils make over time. I'm very fortunate to be supported by two of the highest calibre senior managers, Deputy Head Martin Sanders and Barry Ryder, Head of Care. Excellent teachers and brilliant support staff. Academic, social and experiential learning is only ever maximised, and the progress pupils make can only be described by myself as sublime." And there is a photo of the head teacher Gareth Evans sitting with a cluster of pupils and staff looking very pleased with their outstanding Ofsted report.
MPs concern over proposed changes to legal aid. Winchester and Chandler's Ford MP Steve Bryan has waded into the row over proposed changes to legal aid. Lawyers in Winchester have warned that hundreds of jobs could be lost in the city and throughout Hampshire as a result of a reckless government plan to cut its annual £1 billion legal aid budget. The coalition is looking to introduce price competition and tendering among firms doing criminal work. Addressing the House of Commons, Mr. Brine recounted a letter from a constituent solicitor who had recently defended a man with psychiatric problems. Mr. Brine, a member of the Justice Committee, said, "My constituent's concern is that under price competitive tendering, the duty solicitor, who almost certainly would not know the defendant, might well advise a guilty plea with an alien barrister, either in the magistrate's court or at the first appearance in the Crown Court. My constituent tells me that the fee is the same for a guilty plea as it is for a short trial. So what is the incentive to have a trial? Currently, those in police custody can request any solicitor on the county's roster. Under the government proposals, that choice would be scrapped, and firms providing legal aid in Hampshire would be reduced from 45 to just 9. In May, Barrister Andy Houston of Winchester's Pump Court Chambers told the Chronicle, "I think we're going to see large organisations, Eddie Stobart lawyers, come in. The local solicitors' firms, as they are now, will have to make large-scale redundancies. The out-of-area providers who come in should use local lawyers, but I don't think they will. I can see large firms in London seeing Hampshire as only an hour away." The Justice Minister, Chris Grayling, claims the changes will save £220 million a year, and lawyers' responses to the government's consultation paper are now being considered, with the tendering process slated for autumn this year.
Kate wins National Bokia title, if I pronounced that properly. Charlesford schoolgirl Kate Keemish won the under-19 visually impaired Bokia National Championships in Nottingham. The Year 10 pupil at Toynbee School, who was unplaced at last year's event, claimed her first tournament victory. Bokia, a form of French boule, is designed for athletes of all disabilities. In the blind division, competitors are blindfolded and attempt to locate the ball using a grid and peg system, which has different textures. Kate, who also enjoys judo, skiing and blind cricket, won her first round game 9-0 and went on to beat defending champion Ben Laidler to claim top prize. "Where the school have encouraged the sport, she's just got better and better," said Kate's mother, Bridget. "She learnt the sport at school, where they've really accommodated different sports. All we want now is funding for a club down here. There's nothing in the local area, so it would be great if there could be a club." Kate now qualifies automatically for next year's championships, which is fantastic. There's a lovely picture of a smiling Kate holding up her big gold medal.
And this one is, ship restoration is an absolute disgrace. £500,000 of taxpayers' cash spent while making cuts. Cash-strapped Hampshire County Council has paid out more than £500,000 of taxpayers' cash to restore a First World War warship, the Chronicle can reveal. The county approved £250,000 for a refit of the gunboat known as the HMS M33 Minerva in this year's budget, whilst cutting public services, as previously reported. But figures attained by the Chronicle reveal it had already spent £338,000 on the ship. The bill included restoring the former rusting hulk, which the council bought for £11,000 in 1990, to her original 1915 external condition. New masts, anchors and guns were made from scratch. The Tory-controlled council spent £65,000 blasting and repainting the exterior of the Monitor gunboat, which is berthed at Portsmouth Historic Dockyard, near Nelson's flagship HMS Victory. The coastal bombardment vessel is one of only two British First World War ships still surviving. The latest refit is a joint project with the National Museum of the Royal Navy to mark the 100th anniversary of the Gallipoli campaign, where the gunboat provided support for the landing of Allied forces in 1915-16. But the sums spent have angered taxpayers and Liberal Democrat opposition councillors, who have accused the council of frittering away public money. It comes at a time when the council has made £100 million saving over the past 2 years and axed 17,000 jobs. Christine Melson, leader of the anti-council tax group, Is It Fair?, stormed. I think it is an absolute disgrace when the council spend money on fripperies. They say they are being squeezed, yet they spend huge sums on things like this that have little or no benefit to the local taxpayers. They have frittered the money away. Councillor Keith House, leader of the opposition Liberal Democrat group on the county council, said, "With cuts still biting to libraries, buses and children's centres, there are greater priorities for Hampshire's cash." Some £102,000 was paid out in rent and business rates to berth the ship at Portsmouth Dockyard over the past 23 years. Other work included making the hull watertight, stabilising corrosion, high-tech rust removal and internal structural work. The ship is the largest artefact in the county's museum collection. However, the council refused a Freedom of Information request for a breakdown of costs, saying it doesn't keep records for more than 6 years, in line with the national guidelines from the National Archives Council. Councillor leader Roy Perry asked officers involved in the project to disclose the total cost of the work, and they confirmed the figure was around £160,000. The council boss defended the expenditure, saying the major and rare vessel was part of Britain's maritime history and a tourist attraction. He said volunteers had carried out a significant amount of the work and helped to keep costs down. Councillor Perry said £1.8 million is now being sought from the Heritage Lottery Fund and other sources to fully restore the vessel. Once the revamp is complete, she will be handed over to the National Museum of the Royal Navy. Councillor Perry added that £250,000 earmarked in this year's budget for the ship had come from the sale of a former County Council museum building in Portsmouth. In 2010, the council gave £1 million to the new Mary Rose Museum at Portsmouth Dockyard. And there is a picture of HMS M33 Minerva in a state of semi-repair at the dockyard.
Thank you, and that concludes the extracts for this week. Thank you to our editors, Roz and Peter Lydiard. Thanks to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation team. And it's goodbye from our readers, Shirley Parnell.
Goodbye.
Noel Thorpe Tracy.
Goodbye.
And Jane Harding.
Goodbye.
And from me, Roy Favell, it's goodbye for now. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the week ahead. Don't get too hot out there. Please post your memory sticks back in the yellow wallet, together with the laminated card, when you've finished listening. Thank you and goodbye again.